Good morning and welcome. This is our sixth informational hearing for the Select Committee on Justice Reinvestment, and I want to welcome my co-chair, Mr. Joan Sawyer, and we may be joined by other members of the Select Committee a little later this morning. This committee was tasked with exploring practices that could be adopted or expanded to improve the criminal justice system and reduce the prison population. We've also been, of course, bringing up sentencing reform at each of the committee hearings because the topic itself is tethered to that. So today we're going to focus on the juvenile justice system and the efforts to stop the so-called schools to prison pipeline. And I know my co-chair has been very, very active and interested in that issue, and serves as a committee chair for the sub-budget committee and on public safety, and we are in conversations with our budget committee and our budget chair around adequate funding for the things that we know are working. And you know, I was a teacher for many, many years, 28-29 years, and I know from experience that you can't punish youth into success. And our first panel will provide background on the juvenile system and juvenile justice realignment, which limited admission to DJJ only to juveniles who commit violent, serious, or sex crimes. Our second panel's focus is on education. We will hear about using restorative practices in the public school system. We will also find out about educational opportunities for youth housed at DJJ. And while we may not touch on it at this committee hearing, our Attorney General has introduced a package of bills dealing with truancy, and candidly and with all due respect, I am wary of some of these bills because they look like they're dealing with the district attorneys, which in and of itself isn't bad, but there could be a criminalization aspect. There was a previous bill sponsored by Mr. Leno and Ms. Harris that created a misdemeanor for parents of chronically truant kids from K to 8. And while the intent was good, I did have a problem with that. So that is something else we'd like to address. And then the third panel, or rather the next panel, will focus on youth trauma and development, and we'll explore how trauma affects child brain development and how it can lead to involvement in the criminal justice system. And finally, our last panel is comprised of several individuals who have had personal experiences with the juvenile justice system. And I did hear one young man speak a few weeks ago and was very, very impressed. I think you will be too. And now I'd like to, before we start our first panel, turn it over to my esteemed co-chair, Mr. Joan Sawyer.
Thank you, Mr. Armiano. For me, this is probably one of the most important hearings that we're going to have on reinvestment. If you go to my office, if you ever have a chance to come to the Capitol, go to my office, and you go to my front door, there's a sign that says, talks about closing the school to prison pipeline. The most important part of that, as far as effectuating significant change in our prison system and reducing recidivism, is let's not have people go to jail at all. Let's have them go to college instead of going to jail. Right now, that pipeline is probably this large. We need to fill it with opportunities for jobs, going to school, going to military, so it starts to shrink and shrink and shrink until we eventually start choking off the number of people who go to prison. And so the efforts of this panel that's coming up now and the others, you play a vital role in hopefully quickly reducing the amount of people that are in prisons, and that hopefully one day, and I'm a very optimistic person, and yes, I only have 11 more years to be here, but we'll hopefully we can start a dialogue about how we can just significantly reduce the amount of people that go to jail. And the ones that want to go, let them go, have a good time. We have jail cells for them. But there's got to be an answer for young people who are in despair and are in unfortunate situations, and that ultimately lead them into a place that is not very good for anyone. And so I'm really excited. I'm going to be quiet now because I came to hear from you and not to hear me ramble on. Thank you.
You're 11 years, huh? 11 years in the shoe. God forbid. Any other comments? We're joined by Ms. Melendez and Ms. Brown. Any comments before we begin our panels? Okay. All right, our first panel is Mr. David Steinhardt and Mr. Brian Goldstein. And this is kind of an overview of the California Juvenile Justice. And you guys got about 20 minutes, more or less. So, Mr. Steinhardt, would you? I love your aquarium, by the way.
Thank you so much for inviting us to this hearing. And thank you, both of you in particular, for the work you've done to move the juvenile justice system forward in California. I am David Steinhardt. I am the director of the Commonweal Juvenile Justice Program, a policy and research organization based in Marin County. I've worked for almost 30 years, I would say, closely with legislative leadership on some key juvenile justice reforms that endure today, including the Kids Out of Jail Bill back in 1985, the Juvenile Justice Crime Prevention Act in the year 2000, and importantly, SB 81 in 2007, the Division of Juvenile Justice, or CYA, realignment bill. I'm also the Senate appointee to the Board of State and Community Corrections, and I have to issue the disclaimer that I speak for myself and my organization, but not for BSCC today, although I'd like to take about 1 minute to talk about some very critical juvenile justice work that we are doing through BSCC and where we have some high hopes. Again, thanks for the hearing. A lot of your work and the work in this building is focused on adult prison realignment. And sometimes we perhaps forget that the candidates for prison realignment tomorrow are the kids in the juvenile justice system today. We've come a long way in juvenile justice reform in California. But let's not forget that we need to stop the flow to the prison system from that system. And I think we're doing, you know, a fair job, though there's more we could do. I was asked to summarize trends in an overview, and I've provided the members of the committee with a PowerPoint, which I see is in color, which I'm amazed at, and a lot of slides, and I want to refer to them just a little bit. So I'm going to spend a few minutes on overview. I'm going to try to honor the very short time that we have and refer briefly to those slides. So, and then I do want the opportunity to comment on where, from my experience and perspective, you might want to think about going next. And from a reinvestment perspective, that is the focus of this committee. Trends, public safety. The long-term trend for the juvenile justice system by the slim data we have is good and is reassuring. And if you look in your packet of slides 4 and 5, you will see that the solid data we have on arrests shows a steady and durable downward trend. So felony arrests, both as to the number and the rate, are down by 60% over the last 17 years, and that's reflected in that chart, which has two axes. Chart number 4, as I see you flipping through, they were not correctly reproduced, but I think you can read them. So that's alone a reassuring trend. And then if you look at the thing we all worry about, violent crime, as measured by arrests, down, down, down. So the rate of juveniles arrested for violent crime in California down by about 63% over that same 17-year period. And kids are doing a little bit better than adults in that respect, I might add. Incarceration levels way down in California. The Division of Juvenile Justice, I'm going to talk briefly about, you'll see a chart in there, has been realigned down to a shadow of its former self. And the incarceration levels in our county facilities, juvenile halls, camps, and ranches, down, down, down to about 55% of capacity and down 25% over the last 3 years. Of course, if you have fewer arrests and candidates going in, you have fewer filling up the facilities. And that does raise some questions about use of unused space. I think CJ may want to address that. These dramatic declines and this good news has come in the wake of substantial realignment of the California juvenile justice system. That realignment began back in 1996 when we had 10,000 young people locked up in the California Youth Authority, which wasn't doing such a great job, and that's why we tried to realign it. And I don't need to go over that territory, but via litigation and legislation, we realigned it massively and more structurally in a more sound way than any other state in the country. Others followed in our wake. California really set a structural model for realignment when it adopted SB 81 back in 2007. And, of course, we're talking about investment and reinvestment, and the key to that negotiation happening, the key to shutting down the capacity of DJJ and the CYA was money. So we invested the state money that it took to house those kids at $250,000 a year in the state facility, put it back down at the counties, and now the Youthful Offender Block Grant supplies those counties with over $100 million a year to take care of those kids in those cases.
It was $250,000 per kid?
Was $250,000. Which was one of the reasons that Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger finally came around and said, whoa, you know, enough. Because there was a lawsuit hanging over their heads, the news was bad, the publicity was terrible, and the money was bad. So the case was made to not keep spending that money in that way. When realignment legislation went forward in 2007, the fear was we're going to send all these bad kids back down to the counties, crime's going to go wild. Did not happen. So realignment has been consistent with these good public safety numbers that you see. We have also, as a state, made a substantial investment, justice investment, in state and county funds outside of SB 81, and that is the Juvenile Justice Crime Prevention Act, which I had some role in bringing about back in the year 2000, and another fund, the Juvenile Probation Camp Fund. These state funds supply counties with almost $400 million a year. And the miracle is, and thanks to your help in this legislature, those funds have persevered and been refunded through some very down budget cycles. And so that investment in the juvenile justice system on the prevention side has paid off substantially. But I want to sound a little word of caution. We cannot take these funds for granted. They are locked away in public safety accounts under realignment now, and that's good. But we see them targeted from time to time. We see now the administration has a number of trailer bills that would apparently kill the reporting requirements and the information we get about how those funds are being spent, about how successful they are. The language is not clear yet, but there seems to be a move to pour the money at the counties without much in the way of accountability. We have accountability built into these funds now. It's bare bones, and we want to protect the accountability that we do have. We also see from time to time, especially out of the Assembly, proposals to bundle all these state and county funds together, YOBG, JJCPA, and merge them into one pot for, you know, coordination and convenience. I caution against that because those funds serve different groups, the realignment group coming out of DJJ, and then a prevention cluster at the local level, number one. Number two, they have different structures, and those structures are very important to maintain. And in the attempt to merge them, we don't want to lose those structures.
Oh, do you have a question for you?
Yes.
No, I don't have a question. I was trying to get your attention.
I'm trying to talk fast because I only got 10 minutes to do this all. So the Juvenile Justice Coordinating Council model is a great model of local funding because under the Juvenile Justice Crime Prevention Act, the money goes to the counties, kind of to probation, but stakeholders at the local level under these coordinating councils make the final allocation decision based on local needs. So if we start to mush and merge and blend these accounts, we don't want to lose some of their best features. Anti-supplantation also built in to Juvenile Justice Crime Prevention Act. We don't want the money going to the county and then flipped over and being spent somewhere else. So watch out for that.
Thank you. And
then I want to congratulate you again for maintaining these important funding sources over some very down and difficult budget years. I want to talk in the very few moments that I really have left about accountability and outcome measures for the juvenile justice system and about the very difficult and sometimes boring subject of data. I would be remiss if I didn't take advantage of this opportunity to report how completely disorganized and retarded our juvenile justice data systems are in California. We have okay arrest data, but the quality train pretty much stops there. We have no measures of recidivism that are comprehensive for kids going through the system or tied to those funding streams that I just described. Our primary data network reporting on juvenile justice outcomes and activities is the Juvenile Court and Probation Statistical System, the JCPSS, which by DOJ, Department of Justice's own admission, is a technological dinosaur more than 13 years old. We have fractured data collection from DOJ, my agency, the Board of State and Community Corrections, and that data is scattered and incomplete. And at the Department of Justice, because they claim resource issues, we're looking at three-year-old data from their juvenile justice report. They're way behind on that. Compared to other states, we are bottom dwellers when it comes to data collection and the transparency of what's going on in our juvenile justice system. Georgia has a marvelous juvenile justice clearinghouse online. Any member of the public can go there and find out what the facilities are doing, what the recidivism rates are. Florida outpaces us in this regard. Each facility has a recidivism rate that it reports. We have nothing like that in California, though we have very good models of reform, like the 2009 Juvenile Justice Commission report on outcomes, but that report has laid on the shelf. We're spending heavily on the adult side to monitor and report on recidivism rates and outcomes for adult prison realignment. We have no comparable activity on the juvenile justice side. It's been let go. And I think that we really need to do some serious work there. Plus, looking more broadly at the kids in the system, let's not look only at trying to measure recidivism. We aren't even that far down the track. What about the other outcomes? What about the educational prospects of kids who go into these facilities and come out and cannot get back into mainstream schools? What about their mental health status, which is, this is a real problem in the juvenile justice system. About half of the kids in our local juvenile justice facilities have what are called open mental health cases. But, of course, they're unable to access Medi-Cal because of the federal inmate exception. And so we need to begin to think more broadly about measuring outcomes for kids who are justice involved. And I think it's part of the responsibility of this incarceration system that we have to begin to produce at least some information on how well these kids do once they leave.
We will be discussing those in other manners throughout the morning. So if you could conclude so we can hear from the other gentlemen.
I am concluding. I'm about to finish. So I wanted to recommend that that the legislature and your committee consider requiring the Department of Justice and the Board of State and Community Corrections to coordinate in developing and modernizing these data networks. We have last year, we had a research position in the budget for juvenile justice. The governor lined it out. We don't know why. We need that help as well. I'd like to see it restored. Finally, the Board of State Community Corrections, our Juvenile Justice Standing Committee, is working on all these issues, and we would just like to pledge our cooperation with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mr. Goldstein from the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice.
Thank you so much. Good morning to the Honorable Chairs, members of the Assembly Select Committee on Justice Reinvestment. My name is Brian Goldstein. I'm a policy analyst with the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, more commonly known as CJCJ in San Francisco. I should also just preface my remarks by saying that I may touch upon the points that Mr. Steinhardt raised in terms of accountability and oversight and data, but it's just because we think that it's such an important matter. So CJCJ is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that promotes balanced criminal and juvenile justice systems through the provision of direct services, technical assistance, and policy analysis. Our agency mission is to reduce society's use of incarceration as a solution to social problems. California's juvenile justice system is undergoing a remarkable transformation, given a parallel decline in youth incarceration and youth crime. In fact, youth crime is at the lowest point since 1959. Moreover, justice-involved youth are overwhelmingly served locally at a lower cost with better outcomes than the state has historically provided. This changing juvenile justice landscape requires recognition and state support to continue. Given the purpose of this committee, my intent is to highlight three recommendations California can focus on to reinvest these savings in a 21st century juvenile justice system. First, the state can strengthen data collection systems. As David noted, data creates the foundation of sound policymaking. As a research organization, we believe reliable and accessible data are essential to track how youth move through our justice system and whether systems lead to improved public safety outcomes. The Department of Justice and Board of State and Community Corrections, or BSCC, are central state agencies for collecting these data. Unfortunately, due to a lack of investment in these departments, accessing these data is often the hardest part of our work. For example, the latest Department of Justice data available is from 2011. This limits researchers and other parties' ability to conduct essential data analysis that contributes to the decision-making process here in the Capitol. It is these departments' responsibility to provide up-to-date data and adequate investment is necessary to provide this critical service. Unfortunately, the Department of Justice has a cumbersome verification and review process and a lack of resources, which has caused delay in the release of 2012 data. Due to the department budget cuts, they have stopped all other publications related to crime data and no longer respond to public requests, which effectively blocks researchers, policymakers, and the public from critical information related to public safety. The second recommendation would be for the state to elevate innovative community-based models. California's patchwork of county juvenile justice systems has created an environment that produces pockets of innovation and stagnation. Two examples of innovation are the William F. James Boys Ranch in Santa Clara County and the former Fouts Springs Youth Facility in Solano County. Both are examples of local programs that result in long-term stability for high-risk youth and better family reunification. Both of facilities achieve this at a lower cost than the State Division of Juvenile Facilities. The average daily cost of housing youths in Fouts Springs was approximately $191. In comparison, DJF's estimated annual cost per youth for fiscal year 2013-14 is $270,000, which is about $739 per day. The state has a unique responsibility to strengthen and incentivize these innovative programs through sustainable funding and technical assistance. Unfortunately, counties do not have the capacity to incorporate deep and data analysis. Despite Solano County Probation Department's willingness to share data and implement data-driven decisions, they face challenges with their outdated information management systems. This resulted in a cumbersome process that required extensive staff time for them to extract the relevant information, let alone to determine youth outcomes. Thirdly, we'd ask that the state integrate model approaches into juvenile justice funding allocations. California annually allocates millions to counties for a wide array of juvenile justice programs. The state distributes approximately $90 million annually through the Youthful Offender Block Grant, or YOBG, yet the BSCC struggles to consider youth outcomes in the allocation process. In their most recent YOBG report, the BSCC acknowledges, quote, the nature of the data collected precludes our ability to draw inferences about cause and effect relationships between services and outcomes. In addition, a 2012 state auditor's report calls for greater state oversight of YOBG funds, given their potentially valuable impact. As David noted earlier, we are very concerned about potential budget trailer language that would seek to dilute reporting requirements around YOBG. Moreover, the BSCC stands poised to allocate approximately $80 million for a second round of SB 81 county juvenile facility construction later this year. Now, this is a real opportunity for the state to incorporate model facility design and programming into the allocation process. Whereas $80 million may not seem like a lot given the entire state correctional budget, this will have long-term implications for the dispositional options available to youth at the county level. This money is required. Oh, I'm sorry. We want to make sure that the Executive Steering Committee that allocates this money is required to include elements of model community practices that are strength-based, family, centered, trauma-informed. This will be reflective of the direction the state is moving to address the underlying causes of youth crime. In conclusion, the state stands at a crossroads amid juvenile justice realignment and the historic drop in youth crime, which is saving considerable state resources. The state must build on this through reinvesting these resources in stronger data systems, existing community-based models, and funding streams that incentivize data-driven decision-making. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, one question is, there's been a lot of, there's been advocacy for complete closure of the Division of Juvenile Facilities, and of course there's been resistance to this, and admittedly there's a very high-risk, small high-risk population of youth and they're very complex needs, and I'm just wondering, in your perspective, is there any other viable alternative for addressing the needs of this population rather than housing them at the DJF?
You just asked almost the most difficult question we have for juvenile justice in California.
No figure.
If we close DJJ, and you know this, it's implicit in your remarks, almost all of those kids are automatically eligible for adult court and state prison. So DJJ is now the buffer between the juvenile system and state prison for those kids. Can we replace it? We would have to invest, I mean, with the counties, when the governor in 2 years in a row sought to fully close DJJ, the counties went wild and they said, we can't, it's public safety risk, we don't have the facilities, we can't control these kids, we can't provide them with services. And that's the rub, is can we create serious offender programs at the county level to pull that group back from adult court if we close DJJ? Right now, my organization is not in favor of closing DJJ. Here's an astonishing fact, and I'm not going to go farther on this. 148 juvenile court commitments to DJJ in 2012 from a 4.2 million eligible state youth population between 10 and 17. Out of over 4 million kids, only 148 were sent to DJJ by the juvenile courts. So it's a high-cost switch to find alternative programming for them, and until we can do that and create safeguards against making these prison cases, I think DJJ should stay.
And what about best practices in some of these other states? They seem to have had success where we are kind of running in place.
Well, I don't buy that California is retarded in that respect. Yes, I mean, we have the Missouri model. We've seen Texas, Illinois, and Ohio realign their juvenile justice systems, but none of those models deals with offenders at this level of severity or has the kind of realignment structure that we have in California. So we really became a model for what other states like New York are now doing in terms of the complexity and the money part of realignment. So I think we're doing pretty well. The question is, can we create little DJJs that are on a more benign treatment model at the county level? And that's a hard pull. They're in a whole value equation, it may be worth spending those resources in other parts of the juvenile justice system that keep more kids out of the system in the first place, that deal with their mental health problems and the like.
Do you have any thoughts on sentencing reform?
You mean for juvenile justice?
Yeah.
I have no, we're not pushing anything right now. In fact, you have a proposal, the one about creating alternatives for 707s. But our interests lie in improving data collection, in trying to get some sealing of records improvement so that it's not a long stretch for kids to seal the records. And then another bill that never got introduced this year, it might be called sentencing reform, is a mandatory sex offender registration for kids who are committed to DJJ. That needs some fixing. Lifetime registration is just too harsh for most of those kids.
Well, I do have a bill that's met with a lot of resistance on the chamber floor in regard to the tiering of the sex offenders so that we don't overreact to those that were nonviolent in first time. And that is done quite successfully in other states. Be that as it may, I'll tell you, I know that one of the most important things you've been underlining is the data piece, and that's come across loud and clear. Definitely culled that from the discussion. Any comments, questions, Mr. Jones-Sawyer?
My question is probably more historical, and let me tell you where I'm coming from, the lens that I'm looking at. You put out a number of $240,000 per juvenile that we were spending in corrections and juvenile corrections. As a parent who put two kids through Hampton and Morehouse College at $30,000 a year, Mike's wife and I were probably on the hook for about $240,000 for 8 years of college, and we now have somebody that's a teacher and one that's trying to get into med school. What the heck were we spending all that money on back then? Because the reason I'm asking, if I'm here for a long time, we're not going to repeat whatever we did in the past. I just can't fathom spending $240,000 a year in juveniles and not getting anything out of it. So do you have any idea what were they spending all that money on?
Yes. You were spending it on state salaries, mainly the CCPOA-driven salaries was one thing. You were spending it on old institutions. And it wasn't just $250,000 a year. The length of stay was 4 years. So you're talking about a $1 million case with a 70-80% recidivism rate within 2 or 3 years. It was not a good investment, and that's why through litigation and legislation we changed it. I think the problem now really is, you know, we look good, we feel good, the crime rates are down, we've got realignment working, the money's going to the counties, but we really are in the dark. We're going around a blind curve with no headlights when it comes to knowing how well these kids are really doing. How are they doing? What are their reentry prospects? What is their recidivism rate? So in terms of any picture so far away from high def of what's going on with realignment in terms of realignment success and the individual outcomes of these kids, recidivism, education, placement, a place to live, a job, we really have no handle on that, and that gets back to the data issue.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Melendez?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm reading through the data here where it states that since 1999, the number of juveniles incarcerated in county facilities has declined by about 4%. And the number of juveniles incarcerated in state facilities declined by about 60% between 1999 and 2005. And I know there's speculation as to why that is. There are lots of different reasons that one can suggest. But it sounds to me like what you're saying is we have no idea what is happening to these kids once they get out of the system, correct? Despite the fact that the numbers are down, so if you have a 14-year-old that went into the facility, it's according to these numbers, it's less likely that he went back in at the age of 17 because the numbers are down. But you're saying we have no idea what's going on with these kids. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And I mean, I don't want to be, you know, too bleak because probation departments are the service arm of the juvenile justice system. They supervise and track these kids. They try to help. We have private organizations. Some of these young people are in group homes like Boys Republic, which do a very good job at reuniting young people with jobs and families and school. So it's not all bad, but there's no organization to that structure, and there's no sort of state oversight of the success or failure of these kids under realignment and under these other prevention programs like the Juvenile Justice Crime Prevention Act. You started by asking why the populations went down. Partly the pool, the feed in is down because the crime rates are down. So that's number one. Plus, I think that we have a number of alternatives in place funded by the funds that you have supported that we've just described that move that population out. The even county costs are high, and so there's a built-in disincentive to keeping kids in for a very long time. So we do have a fair amount of unused bed space in California, and some people have proposed alternative uses for it. But the reason the state facility rate is down because we don't let them go there anymore. The local rates are down because the crime rates are down.
Okay, so just one final question, Mr. Chairman, if I may, and I'll be brief. In my county, we had what was called youth court, and you're familiar with that. Okay, so I know because of funding that a lot of these programs have been cut, and I'm just wondering if you could offer your opinion on how successful that type of program is in keeping these kids out of a state facility in the first place.
Youth courts come in different shapes and sizes, and the knock on youth courts or teen courts in the past has been that they take lightweight cases and that they actually widen the net for kids who might otherwise be left alone for minor offenses, alcohol, smoking, shoplifting, and the like. But the good news is that a focused youth court, sometimes with it depends on whether you have a judge or attorneys ruling on the cases, or they bring in sometimes groups of peers, young people, depending on the model. So, I mean, it's kind of a mixed bag. I actually helped to build a teen court that was part of the L.A. County juvenile justice system many years ago. And the people making the sentencing decisions were kids. I'm not sure that's the model we have in mind. It is. And you know what? The kids are tougher than the judges. They just love to lock their, you know, friends away.
Oh, yes.
And but they can only do so much in that context. So like a restorative justice model or a community justice model or the San Francisco community court model, I mean, these are good adjunctive models as long as they don't go crazy and pull people into an alternative system that that overdoes itself.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments from the panel? All right, seeing none, gentlemen, thank you very much. That's been very, very good information for all of us, so thank you. And our next panel is Educational Approaches, and we have Commissioner Kim Shree Malfis from Board of Education in San Francisco. Mr. Lawyer, who was a vocational education teacher, is unable to join us this morning, but we do have Ms. Pam Handel, who's a special education teacher. Welcome. Commissioner, would you like to begin?
Thank you, Assemblyman Amiano. Good morning, honorable members of the Select Committee for Justice Reinvestment. I'm Kim Shree Malfis. I am a commissioner on the San Francisco Board of Education. I am coming to the conclusion of my second full term on the Board of Education in San Francisco. And I'm here today to speak to you about the things truly that I believe help end that prison pipeline for young people. And one of them is providing an equitable education for young people, particularly students of color who have come from disadvantaged backgrounds. And inherently, if you know how our country operates, that is primarily all students of color, poor students as well, and students with special needs, I'll include in that category. And the other component for me is the other balancing, which is restorative justice and a restorative approach to disciplinary measures that happen in school and in a very traditional bureaucratic education system. Punitive measures, pushing children out of the classroom, pushing children out of school sites with suspensions and expulsions is not the answer for dealing with harm caused to community members in schools. And in my time on the Board of Education, which is seen through a lens of several decades of working with young people since 1986, it culminates in an understanding that two things that help young people be successful in, as adults, is equitable education and keeping them away from the jail systems and prison systems. And that really means doing everything we can to keep them in the classroom setting and in school sites as a community member, not just as a student, but as a member of the larger school community and as a responsible community member, not just someone who's sitting and getting their education. So what you have in the materials before you are some of the things that I have been able to work in working with my colleagues, been able to do in San Francisco. And we've started this work really in 2005 with a fair practices and fair community effort. But what we found is even with resolutions, they were just words to paper. And unfortunately, that is not implementable in classrooms, which is where we actually needed it to happen. So by the time I came along to the Board of Education, which was in 2007, I worked with colleagues that had been through some of the same things that I had been through, Commissioner, now Supervisor Jane Kim, and now Commissioner, Board President Sandra Fuhrer, all of us working with young people, Commissioner Fuhrer, President Fuhrer, raising three children in the school district, I myself one, and now Supervisor Jane Kim in the City and County of San Francisco, having worked with youth all her adult life, created a restorative justice initiative. And that initiative said, what is the basis of having kids be in school during disciplinary issues? It's really built on a relationship. And as I said earlier, a relationship making them a responsible and accountable community member in their schools, not just sitting and getting an education, being advocates for their own education, and being responsible for speaking to an adult, the person in power, saying, even though you have power over me, you're the adult, I'm the student, how can we interact and build a relationship so you know me and you understand what I'm going through? And what we also know is oftentimes as we see students in school, which is that very, 8 to 3:30 time frame, after they leave and before they get there, they often have to be adults out in the community. And we may not have any idea what goes on in their lives. They have to deal with so many different things besides dealing with themselves, feeding themselves, clothing themselves, housing themselves, taking care of younger siblings, taking care of family members. How do we help them when they get to the school community become an accountable, responsible community member in relationship with the adults in the school site and having them know them as community members, equally accountable and advocating for equitable education for each of them? So what I brought before you is just a conversation around what we've done around restorative practices. And we created that again in 2009 and just recently passed a follow-up resolution in San Francisco, which was our safe and supportive school communities, which helps deal with willful defiance. And that's something that should be very familiar to all of you recently. But let me be specific around restorative practices, which is based the implementation, the practices and the practical implementation of our restorative justice initiative. And specifically, restorative practices in our San Francisco Unified School District, it seeks to build and sustain strong relationships and positive school climate among all members of our school communities. It effectively responds to conflict and behavior infractions using a collaborative problem-solving process that recognizes the impact of one's actions on the community and results in solutions that make things right as possible going forward. It is the reduction of overall numbers and recidivism rates of suspensions and expulsions district-wide, and it minimizes the disproportionate rate of counseling, office referrals, and suspensions and expulsions of San Francisco Unified School District's African American and Latino students. It increases in-class instructional time for students at schools, and it expands parent and community engagement involvement. And so I want to speak to the previous speaker's commentary on data. And for us, it is key. You know, it's, again, words to paper and the idea, the theoretical idea of implementing ideas. If you don't have strong, reliable data to back up what you're actually trying to implement, it's just a guessing game. And we can continue with that, you know, year after year, decade after decade, trying to reach for solutions that you just hope will be successful. But what we've been able to do here is collect strong, reportable data. And through the district-wide implementation of restorative practices. So we started that in 2009, and we've trained over 2,700 of our San Francisco Unified School staff members in restorative practices, 92 introduction presentations at school facilities, which have included over 2,800 participants. That's not just school staff. That's community members, small business owners, you know, because a school site is actually a community site. It is a community hub, and we want all the people in the surrounding communities to participate with school sites. So that's not only community members, that's parents, family participating, as well as school site staff. We've had 28 presentations to, again, parents and families in our school communities, and 43 of our 111 sites have identified restorative practices site leaders. We have incorporated a train-the-trainer model. So that information doesn't just rest with a few people coveting it. We want to train as we ripple outward in our school district. And we've had intensive extra coaches who are now available to go on a crisis situations out to a site, be deployed from our central office out to sites to deal with emergency situations when schools ask for assistance. So we have 50 of those coaches that can be deployed out to across our school district. But in 2009, where we had 3,098 suspensions and expulsions, we've dropped to, in our 2012-2013 school year, to 1,800. Those were for suspensions. So we went from 3,098 to 1,800. So that's 2009 to 2012-13 school year. And similarly for our expulsions, which went from 21 in 2009 to 14 in 2012 and 2013. And those were because of Ed Code violations, where we specifically have to expel for mandatory offenses. So, and then I just wanted to talk about a little bit of an anecdote, which is in anecdotal situation, which is in your packet as well. And actually, it recaps a situation that happened with five students. And these five students had a history of conflict and physical fighting. And we had a restorative circle at the school site where each child was able to represent what happened to them. And they answered these restorative questions. What happened from your perspective? What were you thinking of at the time? What have you thought since the incident? Who was impacted and affected by your actions, including your family and community members? What about the situation was hardest for you? And what do you feel you need to do to make things right going forward? These five gentlemen had been in a heated physical fight and an altercation on a public bus on their way to school. As a result of the participating in the circle, the root causes were discovered behind the conflict, and they were able to repair their relationship, take responsibility for their actions, and address the impact it had on their larger community, not just themselves and not just the five gentlemen in the fight. What we did was follow up with them at a six-month timeline and then a year later, and we discovered that all five shared that they had not been in any other physical altercations and have remained close friends. This is typical of the results of restorative practice, and it's and how we believe that students are accountable and a part of their school community as viable members. What I wanted to also speak to very quickly is, what do we do when students are in the juvenile justice system? So I believe education and keeping them in the school is really the remedy for not having them go into the juvenile justice system. But for students who happen to be in the system, for me and what our results are education, education, education. We have five key charter schools, which is a charter school in our jails, and it's under the umbrella of our sheriff department. It's very successful. It is a national model for education. And I think there were some quotes around the recidivism rates. 28%, I checked with them last week, is their recidivism rate for graduates from their system. Many go on to post-secondary college institutions. That's from the Sheriff's Department. Our public defender's office has a legal education advocacy team, and their reoffending rate is fewer than 13%, 6 to 12 months after exiting the program. And what they do is they put together a team of folks, an attorney for the child that is under 18, a social worker, an education attorney, and a youth advocate. And they collaborate as a team on behalf of the young person.
Okay.
So I just wanted to bring that information to around recidivism.
Thank you very much.
Very helpful.
We'll have some questions, of course, in discussion, but I appreciate everything you delineated. Okay, Ms. Harmel.
My name is Pam Handel, and I'm a special education teacher, and I work at OH Close School in Stockton, which is a Division of Juvenile Justice, old CYA school. I have worked for the department for over two decades, and I've worked at five different institutions, three of which are closed. I knew before coming here, because I have sat before panels before that, there is a lot about Division of Juvenile Justice that you already know. So I'm not going to give you history and that kind of thing. But bear in mind, as you have someone sitting here in front of you, I may be the only person in the room who worked there yesterday and will be back there this afternoon or tomorrow morning. So if you have questions about what's happening today, I'm your gal. I knew that you also wanted to talk a little bit about some implementations of the things like Common Core, which is being implemented across the nation. We are a school district. We have been a school district in California by legislative act since the early 90s, California Education Authority. And we follow, of course, everything that we are supposed to follow and much more. We have already implemented Common Core. Up through the, just to one subject, which is English language arts. We have all of the funding for the training. Training is being done through our local county office of education. So for us in Stockton, that's across the freeway, Highway 99 department, San Joaquin County. Ventura, that would be down there. They're great trainings. We're learning with public school teachers. Common Core is going to be across the nation, as you know. Our only problem that we see is that where we were really used to seeing state standards, they're more embedded, so we're having to dig for them. That was one of the problems that I learned about. I also knew that you were interested in learning a little bit about what we do with our career technical education, or what we used to refer to as vocational education. And so I do work with Mr. Lawyer, who could not make it today because the time frame for getting him here was a little too short. As a special educator, I go into classes and I pull students out. But since I don't have classes, they don't have to get a substitute for me. Mr. Lawyer runs a wonderful program. He has actually spoken in front of some of your comrades before. And I do have a little bit of information about his program. But I wanted to let you know a little bit about possibly some of the things that you're concerned about. Lady next to me mentioned, and the two gentlemen before mentioned, about data. And I think you also said, sir, that data is going to be the word of the day. You're probably interested in things that we can't give you. And teachers have known for decades that our disconnect is the disconnect between us or our department and our students when they parole. We have wonderful programs. We've had wonderful programs for years. We now have even better programs in many ways. DJJ has changed in so many ways in the last few decades, and especially in the last 5 to 10 years. Some of it was realignment driven. Some of it was lawsuit driven. And some of it was simply driven by the times. But we do have great programs for students, and we have a very high graduation rate. We have a very high passage of the high school exam rate. We have a very high rate of students who choose to go to the GED. Their time is a little shorter. They're a little older. They want to get their GED. They want to get some training. They want a job. So we meet those needs behind the wire, as we say. But outside of the wire, there's where the disconnect is. We could not give you some of the data that you might want to know, like how successful are some of these programs. Mr. Lawyer, for instance, runs a program that is all about programming and fixing computers in the real work world. And there's several different certifications that are awarded that are recognized in the industry. And the California Department of Education is now requiring that school districts make sure that students everywhere get at least 10 credits on their high school diploma in some kind of career technical education. So they recognize how important this is too. Our students are getting this, and they're getting exactly what the industry is asking for. Industry is not always asking for someone with a 4-year college degree. They're asking for someone they can put in the seat the day they hire them that can do the job. And Chris Lawyer is one of our wonderful teachers who teaches a program where those students get certifications and can be guaranteed certain things like jobs that may pay $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 a year as they get right in and sit down and can do the job. Not necessarily because they had 4 years of college, but because they have practical hands-on experience. We have other teachers who are like that too. And through the lowering of our population, the years we all experienced of budgetary cuts, realignment, the Farrell Agreement that went up, down, whatever has been happening, whether we have been getting budget cuts or budget enhancements, our teachers have maintained programs where our students have learned how to work in the real world. But our disconnect is we can't tell you how successful that is. We know that they've left with a diploma, a GED, or they're close to it. We know that they've left with contacts. We know that they've left with possibly a job waiting for them. But we do not know how successful that is because inherently we can't ask those questions. We cannot keep track of students because we could actually lose our jobs if we have contact with them. And our department doesn't seem to have made an effort or made that happen where we connect all of these dots. So with the budgetary cuts and realignment, we have fewer parole agents for juvenile. We have fewer parole offices. We used to have actual juvenile parole offices with teachers in them. Those no longer exist. So we couldn't tell you what the success is, but we do know we have the programs available. With the Farrell and some of the other things that we've done in the last few years, and I'm hoping that you do understand what I'm talking about when I say the Farrell decision, but it was a life-altering lawsuit that CYA lost. And the first group that came into alignment was education. The education leadership wrote a remedial plan. We addressed that. And academically, we really connected and we built that up. But one of the things that happened because of budgetary cuts was cutting back of career technical education. If you were asked me about restoring any kind of education programs, I would certainly say that we need to work on restoring the kinds of education programs that students need. I will go back tomorrow and work with a 14-year-old. I will go back tomorrow and I will work with a 20-year-old. They have vastly different needs. One has almost got his high school diploma and is learning a trade that he wants to do in life. The other one hasn't even entered high school yet. Doesn't know how to, you know, do basic plumbing or carpentry or anything. So we need programs that address basic skill needs so that they can take care of themselves and that they can lead into the other programs that we have. We have students now coming in to programs where they need to know how to solder or cut wood, but they can't solder or cut wood, so the teachers have to stop and go back to those basic things. So I would say the restoration of our basic programs would be very good for our students. But as far as our academic education, we are really doing some dynamic programs. We have science programs with labs. We have, like I said, we have a very high rate of graduation per capita. If you look at us, we have a very high rate of passing of the high school exit exam, the other program, the other testing that they have to do. Everything that they have to do in public school, we have to do too. And restorative justice is something that's always important to us. It's been important for a long time. I use a terminology, we reparent these children. We get them, they've had a messy situation. There were so many things that this lady next to me said. She talked about the young people on the bus. Every time we have students that do something, everyone that touches that kid sits down and starts asking those kinds of questions, those open-ended questions. Why did you do this? How did you feel? What would you do differently? And we're trying to get them to think about their actions. Okay. Because they are young, they are impulsive, and we're trying to reparent them. We're trying to do what parents either couldn't do, can't do, didn't do, or aren't there now to do, because we're the surrogate type parent, right? We do have involved parents. We have parent committees. We have student councils. And every week, these young people sit down in many different treatment groups to talk about issues exactly the way this lady was talking about it. Not just talk at them, but communicate back and forth. So restorative justice, it's there. But we have that very unique population.
All right. If you don't mind, could you conclude, and then we'll have some questions for you?
My conclusion is I am willing to answer any question that you have. You have an expert sitting in front of you, so please take advantage of that.
I was a special ed teacher for about 25 years, so I have a great deal of empathy. Ms. Malfus, you know, I remember when I was on the school board, there was an attempt to do outreach to public housing, you know, actually have the meetings there. And is that part of what's happening?
So part of the collaborative effort, when I say community coming together and us reaching out to the community to have those restorative justice presentations, that's all across San Francisco and all different parts of the city. And we pull together all different components besides the business community, the housing community as well, parents, families, anyone involved that are near or surrounding a school site or where they're funneling into the school site, we ask them to come to those presentations.
You want to explain a little bit how the peer thing works? The peer court?
Oh, yes, and I didn't have a chance to mention it. So some of the other answers that we have for our, we have peer courts, and that's where we are training our own young people to be, just as you are sitting on a panel, to help the young person who has caused harm to that community come to a solution. And it's really helping again, a community effort, be accountable, the panel being accountable as and responsible, and working with the young person who's caused harm to that community, and what would be the appropriate restorative approach to help make the community whole again. And that's where our peer courts is. We also have a reentry council, which is, again, they're mandated, but it also includes all of our city departments, lots of community-based organizations, and people who are from the community that sit in on those meetings to offer testimony and support.
You know, to both of you, we have such diversity, of course, in San Francisco, we know. So when these groups happen, is there accommodation to that, language accommodation, cultural accommodation?
Absolutely. That is hands down baseline, making certain that the community is accommodated. And sometimes the presentations are given in a language other than English, and English-only speakers need the electronic accommodation, right? Because it's whatever community is being served the most, they get the language accommodation, and English-only speakers need to wear the electronic device.
What about the young women? You know, usually there's always a dearth of services that we want and programming that we want, and it always seems that girls and the young women get even a little bit more cheated than that. So do you have programs for that? Obviously you don't.
Yeah. We still have and always have had at Ventura a program for young women, and it still exists. And its population has, for some bizarre reason, although I don't know if they're the same people, has maintained right around 50 for about a year or so. And they actually have programs that are geared just for them. They have groups that are geared just for the young women, issues of, you know, of body image, things that young women face, that feeling of self-worth, that we don't necessarily do the same way for young men. And, of course, they have health issues that they come in with. Some of them have, over the years, come in expecting.
Children.
So that we have the connection there so that they can visit, family can visit them. So part of the problem is always going to be distance. But it's been our facility since the facility was built that has always housed women. So distance to get to Ventura has always been a problem. But
any other questions or comments from committee members?
Just quickly, it seems like what's permeating through all of this is about data collection. And I'm not sure, does anyone have any idea what that looks like from a budgetary standpoint? Are we talking about different platforms coming together? Are we talking about downloading information across different levels? I know you mentioned data collection, and in the schools, is it connecting to DJJ and what's going on academically? Is it is it all of that and then some?
So very briefly, yes, all that and then some, and it is imperative for our funding allocation that we have responsible data. And in San Francisco, although we are very close to Silicon Valley, you know, lots of our data systems were antiquated, so we have incorporated several new iterations of district-wide data systems, and we are working to making certain they're updated and in every school. So really, we can find data from each school site trying to push a button, and then that information translating to central office and then being disaggregated across race, gender, cultural background, ethnicity, special ed needs. All of that information can be disaggregated. But again, data is key, as well as the funding to support the data collection and those systems that support correct and reliable data.
If you can get with my office just to talk about the funding aspect of it. I chair Budget Sub 5 Public Safety for the Budget Subcommittee. So I'm really interested in what kind of costs we're talking about.
I appreciate that, and I know my colleague sitting
and
here
I think all panels.
Is going to speak to that because in San Francisco, via our assembly member, we have a public education and enrichment fund, and we pulled money specifically to support, which was violence prevention money, which may have not been directly going to what we thought was violence prevention, pulled it from there and directed it to restorative practices. In our first few years, it was over $600,000, and it's up to $900,000 now. But that also includes the data collection. So I will happily, via assembly member's office, get in contact with your office.
Okay. Mr. Jones-Sawyer?
I'd like to ask a question.
Sure.
Thank you very much. I heard Ms. Handel say that she would lose her job if she stayed in contact with students.
Yes, we have, you know, just like any place else, there are expectations and there's directives. One of the directives on us is that we will not have, I'm a rank and file down in the trenches teacher. We will not have contact, direct contact with students. If we do, if accidentally, let's say I run into one in the store, and this has happened before, I will just let folks know that I've seen this student. However, there's got to be a way of connecting the dots. We have really good data that has been put together. It's either been court-driven or legislative-driven or whatever. But since I started working over 2 decades ago, when everything was handwritten, it seemed like, the data internally is wonderful. I can go on the CDCR website to the Juvenile Justice Palette, and I can find the research page, and I can see the previous month's data on at least population. I can look at various different things for a student on our, we call it our ward information network, WIN. I never refer to our students or our young people as wards, but there you go. We have a lot of, it's that whole problem of the disconnect from inside the wire to outside the wire. And the only connection is our probation or parole officers, and they must have some sort of data on the success of our students leaving with their diplomas or GED, with the certificates that they're getting, and how they're doing. Are they successful? Are they working? Are they continuing their education? Are they taking care of their families? But that connection just doesn't seem to be there. It doesn't filter back to us, and apparently it's not getting to you folks either. So that's the disconnection. I can't quite figure out how to do it or where the funding would be. It seems like it's already there. Just putting two
Thank
things
you.
Together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And since we're getting short on time, I want to thank the panelists for being here, and we'll go on to our next panel. Thank you. The Youth Trauma and Development, Susie Loftus, Center for Youth Wellness, and Matt Cervantes, Sierra Health Foundation. Go ahead, have a seat. And we'll have Ms. Loftus begin first. 10 minutes, and then Mr. Cervantes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Chair Amiano, Co-Chair Jones Sawyer. I'd like to thank all the members of the Select Committee on Justice Reinvestment for holding this hearing and for inviting the Center for Youth Wellness to participate. I first have to start by saying something that Commissioner Shremoffice is going to be thrilled to hear, which is I wear a different hat, which is I'm a parent of two little SFUSD, San Francisco Unified School District children, mm-hmm. a proud graduate of that same school district. And I just heard this week the principal of their elementary school talking about where she was going to put the chill-out room so that they could fully implement the restorative justice practice. So I wanted to share that with all of you and with the commissioner, because sometimes these big ideas, how do they actually filter down to the life of a child and a principal? And I'm very fortunate that I got to hear both of those conversations and share with you all that restorative justice is something that, if you stick with it, you actually can affect that change, and that's happening in the lives of my little ones at their elementary school. But what I'm here to talk about is my name is Susie Loftus, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer at the Center for Youth Wellness, a children's health organization located in San Francisco that's focused on improving the health of children facing chronic adversity. I come to today's discussion from a rather unique perspective. Prior to joining the CYW, I was a prosecutor in San Francisco, where I prosecuted domestic violence, elder abuse, attempted murder, you name it. And as many of you are keenly aware, the stories followed a sad, familiar pattern. Children were exposed to violence at a young age. Some were given up on. Some involved in the juvenile justice system and then graduated into the adult correction system. That is, in fact, one of the reasons we're all here today. What can we do to break the cycle? The juvenile justice system is indeed one of the last opportunities we have to intervene with system-involved youth and prevent them from graduating into the adult correction system. And you will hear shortly from Matt Cervantes about the incredible work the Positive Youth Justice Initiative is doing to create system reform in four California counties. They recognize the impact of trauma and promoting positive youth development to put crossover youth on a path out of the system. What I'm most excited about, who you'll hear from, is Jesse Esparza, a young man who will talk to you about the intervention that actually gave him a way out of the system. But the prevention that I'm going to speak about starts much earlier. It was about 5 years ago when I had a conversation with my boss, then District Attorney Kamala Harris, now the Attorney General of the great state of California, about how we, I see some nodding heads, yes, as prosecutors needed to look at our job differently. We couldn't arrest and prosecute our way out of the cycle of crime in our community. We must do more to prevent kids in violent neighborhoods from falling through the cracks. And we would use science and the magic word of the day, data, to do it. It made sense to me. I had just given the closing argument in a case I prosecuted involving a shooting on 3rd and Oakdale, a particularly violent corner of San Francisco. And the victim in that case was a mother of 8 who was shot in the back of the neck in the middle of the day. This mother had already lost one of her children to gang violence and was struggling to raise her 7 other children. As I sought justice for the crime that occurred to her inside the four walls of a courtroom, as a mother myself, I couldn't escape a nagging concern about the impact that all of this must have on her children. As fate would have it, shortly after the trial ended, I met the passionate Dr. Burke Harris, who hopefully all of you have read about in your packet of materials, a fantastic pediatrician serving the Bayview Hunters Point community, who was demanding a more holistic response to the health impacts of violence on children in Bayview Hunters Point. We needed to start much earlier to create healthier families and safer communities. So at the Center for Youth Wellness, we're committed to making kids healthier and building stronger families by preventing, screening, and healing toxic stress in children and adolescents exposed to trauma. So what are adverse childhood experiences? Adverse childhood experiences are traumatic experiences that a child has while growing up. These experiences can include physical, sexual, or emotional abuse, physical or emotional neglect, or household dysfunction, such as having a parent who's incarcerated or absent, or having a parent with untreated mental illness. Exposure to multiple ACEs deeply impacts the development of a child's brain and body. We are also beginning to understand that other traumatic experiences, like exposure to community violence or homelessness, can also deeply affect the development of a young child. What we know now from the research and the data is that exposure to these traumatic experiences can cause toxic stress in children. When we talk about toxic stress, I want to be really clear. We're not talking about the normal stress of growing up, studying for the big test, or getting ready for the big game. Toxic stress is the result of frequent, prolonged, and chronic activation of the body's stress response system, the fight or flight mechanism. Due to traumatic experiences like ACEs, toxic stress in a child can cause changes to her body's stress response system, her immune system, and even how her DNA is read and transcribed. These changes to the fundamental architecture of a child's brain and body can result in a lifetime of poor outcomes. In 1998, doctors Vincent Felitti and Robert Onda published what has become to known as the ACEs study. You have a copy of it in your packet. This study is perhaps the single most important public health study of our time, but most people have never heard of it. The study was groundbreaking because for the first time, it showed direct correlations between childhood adversity and negative outcomes. Looking at 17,000 adults who were members of Kaiser Permanente San Diego, the research found that a majority of those people surveyed, please note 75% white, educated, and middle or upper income, had at least one adverse childhood experience. They also found strong correlations between individuals with high numbers of ACEs and poor health outcomes, including diabetes, COPD, cancer, asthma, liver disease, and the number one killer in America, ischemic heart disease. Other studies have found that a woman with 7 or more adverse childhood experiences is 5.5 times more likely to become pregnant as a teen, and a woman with 3 or more violent adverse childhood experiences is 3.5 times more likely to become victim of intimate partner violence, while a man with three violent ACEs is 3.8 times more likely to perpetrate intimate partner violence. And poor outcomes caused by ACEs don't occur only in adults. They occur also in children. A study by CYW founder and CEO Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris and Dr. Victor Carrion from Stanford's Lucile Packard Children's Hospital looked at the impact of ACEs on children who were patients at the Bayview Child Health Clinic, where Dr. Burke-Harris was their physician. They looked back at 700 of those children living in Bayview Hunters Point. The average age of those patients were 8. The most alarming statistic of all, which is very instructive to all of you as policymakers, is that children in Bayview, Hunters Point, who had zero ACEs, only 3% of them had a learning or behavior problem in school. Same neighborhood, zero adverse childhood experiences. If you had four or more adverse childhood experiences, 51% of those children, same neighborhood, had learning or behavior problems in school. At the Center for Youth Wellness, we're committed to improving the health and lives of these children by addressing adverse childhood experiences and toxic stress. Our model integrates primary health care, mental health and wellness, research, policy, community, and family support. At the heart of our work is a commitment to children and their caregivers, supporting the path towards wellness. We are engaged in truly groundbreaking work, but we cannot do this alone. A single organization cannot repair generations of trauma caused by poverty, incarceration, and illness. However, health begins with hope. We can begin to improve the health and lives of children and families facing chronic adversity by preventing, screening, and healing toxic stress. We need to do more to raise awareness about toxic stress and ACEs throughout our state and nation. We need to do more to raise awareness so that every parent, pediatrician, and policymaker should be familiar with the words toxic stress and adverse childhood experiences. In California, I'm going to bring up the magic word again, we need to do more to track and collect data on ACEs so we can begin to understand the scope of this public health crisis in Los Angeles. And I'm going to close with a story because I'm getting the close sign. Last week I saw a 6-year-old named Nicole, I'm going to call her Nicole, bounding down the stairs of our Center for Youth Wellness. She was headed to a cooking class with her former foster, now adoptive mother. This was a powerful moment for me in preparing what I was going to talk to you guys about because I know Nicole's history. She entered the foster care system when she was 2, and in her 6 short years, she has already witnessed 3 murders in Bayview Hunters Point and lives in one of the most violent housing projects. Through our integrated model of care, we have treated Nicole and her mother, and she has benefited from that treatment. The story is important because the statistics tell us that a child with Nicole's background has a grim and challenging future. But because of her doctor, who recognized the impact of the adversity on her and her mom, she now has an opportunity for a brighter future. We don't have all the answers yet, but we can't afford to sit by and let another generation of children filter into the criminal justice system. We can do something. Thank you for your interest in this issue.
Thank you, Ms. Loftus. Mr. Cervantes.
Well, good morning. Good morning, Chairman Amiano and Co-Chair Joan Sawyer. Appreciate the opportunity. My name is Matt Cervantes. I'm Senior Program Officer at Sierra Health Foundation. I'm the staff lead for our Positive Youth Justice. Senior Program Officer at Sierra Health Foundation.